perhaps, you know, in some ways it's maybe easier to tell someone when a person that you don't know, some random, a stranger approaches you or says something or does something or sends you something. But what about when that's someone that you love and that you trust or that is loved and trusted in your family? In most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases, when a child's harmed, they know the person that's harming them. You know, sometimes we're socialized in ways that, you know, children need to do what adults say all of the time. And children, you know, they can be so scared and so confused with what's happening that it just makes it sometimes almost impossible for them to talk with someone. And we have to understand that.
I'm Sarah Kearns and welcome to the podcast. This is a safe space to discuss the topics affecting everyday families. Let's take an inside look into our own realities and the realities of others. We'll learn together as knowledge creates empathy. Empathy shapes the way that we act, and those actions can change our family and those around us. This is the Conscious Project. Content warning. This episode discusses child sexual abuse. If you need further support after the episode, please see the show notes for resources. Experts are telling us we are in a child sexual abuse epidemic in Australia. None of us want to believe that someone close to us or our child would ever sexually abuse them. But the statistics tell us that abusers are generally people who are trusted by the child's family and who are given access to the child. I'm joined today by Kaylin Kerr, a former police officer with 24 years experience in study and in law enforcement investigating sexual crimes. Kaylin is highly experienced, educated, and is recognised as one of WA's most experienced providers of child protection workshops. Through her company, eSafe Kids, Kaylin provides national and international workshops and webinars to children. She also educates parents, teachers, and other professionals on how to talk with children, young people, and vulnerable adults about protective behaviours and body safety. This conversation may not be for little ears. It's full of hard truths and terrifying statistics, but it's a conversation that parents and carers of children need to be a part of. It's also full of simple and practical tips to help educate and empower our kids and to protect them from abuse. Hi, Kaylin. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Sarah.
This is such a necessary conversation, and you're doing the most inspiring work within the child protection space. And it's amazing that parents who may not have access to this information are going to hear it here today.
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic opportunity to speak to as many parents, carers, grandparents, and anyone that lives with or works with children.
I think a lot of parents are scared to talk to their kids about body safety and protective behaviours because they think they're going to introduce them to this big, scary, horrible world, and they're trying to protect them and, you know, their innocence. But I read a quote on your website, which is eSafe Kids. For everyone listening, all of these resources will be in the show notes, so you'll be able to find Kaylin again very easily. And the quote said, teaching children about body safety doesn't take away their innocence, but it helps to protect it. I just thought that was so powerful.
Yeah, absolutely, Sarah. In my work and over many years, what I've found very often is that parents often want to have conversation with their children. Sometimes they just don't know how to do it. And sometimes parents are fearful of introducing information that is not age or stage developed. Mentally appropriate, introducing content that the child is not ready for. And sometimes what happens is that fear ultimately results in the child not getting any conversation and any education. And so the part that I like to try and fill is supporting and inspiring parents to have these, what can be sensitive, challenging, and sometimes difficult conversations with their children and with their young people.
Yeah, so true. And I think that parents are realizing that, you know, the education that we all got and that it's been so long has been centered around just telling kids don't get into cars and be aware of strangers and, you know, that a predator will look like this scary person in a scary hood and you'll get that, you know, immediate reaction that you'll be fearful. But it's just not the case.
No, not at all. And I want to say here that talking to children about stranger danger and safety in that context is actually very important, but it cannot be a message that we give our children in isolation. And what tends to happen is it is the conversation we have with children, because it was the conversation and it was the education that we were given when we were children or we were young people. So we kind of default to what we're comfortable with. And you know what? When I go and speak to children and young people, upper primary school, sometimes they talk about it, but definitely in high school, young people will talk about being able to describe someone who might be dangerous or be unsafe for them. And oftentimes what they're describing is that notion of a stranger. And I think important conversation, but one absolutely not being had in isolation, because the reality is, in the overwhelming majority of cases, if a person is going to harm a child, whether that be sexually or otherwise, it is going to be someone that the child already knows, that the parents usually know, and is quite well known in the community as well. And that's the reality.
That's terrifying.
It absolutely is. And you know what, Sarah, on top of everything that I do, I'm a mum as well. I have two children. And as a parent, you want nothing more than for your children to be happy. Well, most of the time happy, but healthy and safe. And, you know, we want to protect them so much. And it makes it so difficult then when we have to consider that, you know what, the reality is, if my child was going to be in an unsafe situation and, you know, possibly harm, It might be someone that I already know. It might be someone in my family or my friendship circle. And that's what makes this such a challenging conversation.
And do you think that the common misconceptions held by parents is that, you know, nobody in their circles would ever do that to my child? And, you know, I'm sure that happens to other people in the news, but it would never happen to us, or we only have great friends or great family, or, you know.
Absolutely. And young people tell me this as well, like they'll accept that sexual abuse happens or unsafe situations happen, that children are harmed, but it would never happen in their family, in their community. Yeah, sure, it happens, but not where I am. And I think that is a myth or a misconception that we really need to debunk, because the reality is children are harmed in all sorts of contexts, irrespective of your geographical location, your socioeconomic status, whether you're in a metropolitan area, regional or remote area. Those factors don't come into play when we look at children being harmed. And again, how challenging is that to consider? It's confronting. And I think that this opportunity to talk to parents about that and then look at the ways in which we can acknowledge that this does happen and give children some skills and strategies so that they can potentially identify some unsafe situations and know how to respond and know how to access help and support if they ever needed it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such important work you're doing. So let's just, because I know that everyone will be listening and falling immediately back into that, oh, it wouldn't happen to us. So let's just talk about, you know, how many children are being abused? What's the common age for this abuse?
Yeah, Sarah, for many years now, I have been saying that, you know, this is a silent epidemic. This is the health epidemic that we do not talk about. And I understand why we don't talk about it, but we absolutely need to, because this is just so common. So if we just look at, say, the 2018 and 2019 reporting year, in Australia, in our country, there were over 62,700 substantiations of child abuse and neglect in our country. And that included over 4,700 confirmed or substantiated cases of child sexual abuse. And do you know what's really important here, Sarah, to note is that this only accounts for the cases that have been reported and that have been identified. And we know that sexual offences, both child sexual abuse and sexual assault and violence, are perhaps the most underreported offences that we have for a whole host of reasons. Some Australian estimates are that approximately 30% of all children living in Australia have experienced child abuse. That's staggering. One child is one child too many.
It's just beyond belief, isn't it?
It is.
When you break it down and you think about, you know, these aren't just nameless kids. You know, they're kids in our kids' classes, in their footy teams, you know, the little kids we smile at swimming, you know, any of these kids could be one of those statistics. And it's something we need to be talking about, no matter how horrible it is to think about.
Do you know, in the most recent Australian Bureau of Statistics survey that they did, what they found was in Australia, approximately 1.4 million people have experienced sexual abuse before the age of 15, and over half, so nearly 60% of those that had been sexually abused, the first time that abuse occurred, they were under the age of 10 years.
God, it's just so
it's staggering.
It does. It breaks your heart.
It does.
Once they've been abused, is the statistics then they're more likely to continue being abused with other offenders, or, you know, does it sort of drop back off, or?
So what we do see, I mean, not all children who are sexually abused and tell and get the help and support that they need will be re-victimised. But what we do know is if we don't support children that have been sexually abused, and when I say support, I mean therapeutically support those children and their families as well, then those children, because of vulnerabilities that perhaps still exist, are more likely to be abused again by the same or a different person. Ensuring that we have services that are able to provide therapeutic support is so important. And the other thing that sometimes people don't consider, and I hear it all the time, and the language we use is just so important. But sometimes people will say, well, you know what, that happened 20 years ago. You know, you must be over it by now. Well, that happened 50 years ago. Like, get over it. And the reality is for any person, a child, young person or adult who experiences trauma, it is something that will very likely live with them forever. And for some people, it changes the whole trajectory of their life. And so we need to approach this subject and this topic area with a huge degree of empathy and compassion and kindness. And, you know, when I work with children, young people in high school, that's the foundation of my work. And even when I speak to adults, is trying to dispel some of these myths that surely if a child was being sexually abused, they would stop it after the first time that it happened, or surely they would tell someone straight away. And these are just myths that we need to dispel, because overwhelmingly that does not happen.
And why do you think that is? I know we're going to talk further into that later, but why are children not speaking up?
I think that there are a whole host of reasons why children perhaps don't tell, or children do tell and their disclosure is missed, or that they do tell and the person they tell might listen to them but might not believe them. The person that they tell may listen to them, might believe them, but may not get them the help and the support that they need for a whole range of reasons. Also, I think perhaps one of the things that is not spoken about is because, you know, 90 to 96% of all child sexual abuse is committed by someone that the child knows, usually known by the family as well. It's not a stranger most of the time. This adds this huge layer of complexity. It is perhaps, you know, in some ways, it's maybe easier to tell someone when a person that you don't know, some random, a stranger approaches you or says something or does something or sends you something. But what about when that's someone that you love and that you trust, or that is loved and trusted in your family? In most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases, when a child's harmed, they know the person that's harming them. And that makes this just in and of itself so, so, so complex and so, so difficult for them. And then when we look at grooming behaviours that often occur, children are sometimes threatened, sometimes they're lied to, sometimes they're made to feel guilty or ashamed or responsible for what has happened. And this is difficult for adults to reconcile, very, very difficult. So now put yourself into the position of a child who relies, who has less power and has less control and less knowledge about sexual things. They depend almost entirely on adults for their care and their supervision and their protection. They may be lacking, they're naive because of age and lacking knowledge. And this is where we can start to fill some of these gaps. You know, sometimes we're socialized in ways that, you know, children need to do what adults say all of the time. And children, you know, they can be so scared and so confused with what's happening that it just makes it sometimes almost impossible for them to talk with someone. And we have to understand that.
It's just heartbreaking. You're just breaking my absolute heart. Like, I just think of my little babies in that situation, and you think they struggle sometimes to just tell me that they're feeling overwhelmed because it's a school day, or, you know, they're feeling overwhelmed because they've got a decision to make, whether it be, you know, do I want to do this or that? And then you think these are massive traumatic situations and how they're supposed to deal with that.
And the reality is, you know, those statistics we spoke about just a short time ago, you know, we can say 1.4 million, but let's just think about the one child that's experiencing this. And, you know, as I said, I'm a mum myself. And at the time that I had my first child, I was working at the child abuse squad and investigating, you know, horrific things. And, you know, before you have children, I think sometimes you have all these ideas about what you're going to do and how you're going to do it and what your child's going to be like. And then they arrive and you go, oh, wow, like, nothing.
I had no idea.
Oh my goodness. I had no idea. And all these things that I thought I'd do and they'd do just go out the window. And do you know what? It was the very first day that I had my son home from the hospital, and he's laying on the change table and I'm changing his nappy and, you know, lots of talking and gooing and just like smelling him and all that gorgeousness. And then I looked at him and in that moment, first day home on the change table, even though for many years I'd investigated sexual crimes, I'd studied sexual crimes when I was at university, and I knew that children are vulnerable. It was in that moment that I looked at my own child and that vulnerability and that need for me and trusting adults to care for him. It hit me in a way that it had never before. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to take everything that I know and all the knowledge that I have, and I'm going to give my child some skills and strategies that may help him through his life. I'm going to start it really young. And from that day forward, I say to parents, if my child deserves this and if my children get this from me, my belief is that every child, irrespective of where they're born and who they're born to, deserves this as well. And so that's kind of what my life's been about, is protecting and serving and supporting and inspiring everyone to have these difficult conversations, but in ways that we can be comfortable with, that are age and developmentally appropriate, that takes into consideration whether we have a child with learning difficulties, differences, and children with a whole range of abilities, and children with disabilities also. And you know what? It just... I'm looking at the next sort of 20 something years of my working life after I finished the first 25. And, you know, I'm so passionate and I'm excited because there's so much work to be done.
You are amazing. We're so grateful that we've got a bit of time from you today. It's just such an important conversation. So I thought perhaps let's start with our warning signs, and just in case, because I'm, you know, with those kinds of statistics, I'm well aware that people are going to be sitting there listening to this going, oh my gosh, what should I be looking for? What if this is my child and I don't know? And, you know, so I thought let's go over that, and then we may give our parents some tips and some ways to empower their children, educate their children. We might break it up into, you know, that pre-primary, primary, and then high school age so that we cover everybody today.
When we talk about, you know, warning signs to look out for and that type of thing, I guess I just want to say firstly, yes, sometimes there are perhaps what we'd say some obvious warning signs, whether that be physical signs on a child's body, or perhaps there's some behavioural indicators, so the way the child's now behaving or things that they're doing. But I really want to be clear that sometimes that just doesn't exist, and sometimes it's only when you look backwards that you're able to connect the dots. And a lot of parents, they carry a huge degree of shame and blame because they didn't see the warning signs, and they can see them when they look back on reflection. But we have to be kind to ourselves. Oftentimes, there might not be any signs, or the signs might be, we might think it relates to something else. And so we have to be, I want parents, and particularly parents that may be listening, that, you know, this has touched their family or their friendship circle in some way, signs and I just want to be really careful that, you know, don't blame yourself if perhaps maybe you just didn't see something, and there just might not be anything to see. Some things that perhaps we might see, and any one of these things in isolation, even a few of them, it does not mean necessarily that the child has experienced some form of abuse. There can be a whole host of other things going on. But, you know, child that maybe is sort of acting in a sexualized way that is not appropriate to that age and stage that they're at. Sometimes it could be children displaying some harmful sexual behaviors on themselves or on other children or a doll or an animal. Sometimes children will process and try and even tell about their abuse through stories or artwork and drawing. They might start doing things that you thought they'd grown out of. So children that, you know, might now suddenly want to have the light on at nighttime, bedwetting, perhaps, you know, a child that is past toilet training, but now they're soiling themselves. Nightmares sometimes, and some unexplained fears or fears that just don't seem to align with what's going on in their life, and things like that can be either physical or behavioural indicators that a child could be getting sexually abused. But something I want to say there is we also then these days, in a way we didn't have to not too many years ago, consider that these could be signs of a whole host of different things going on in a child's life. It could be in relation to, you know, a friendship issue that they're having at school. It could be in relation to anxiety or some other something else that's going on. And also, it might not be that the child is being sexually abused, you know, and I'll say in the real world or in their community. It could be that they've been online and someone has sent them something, or they've been shown something, or they've heard something that was particularly upsetting for them. And I speak to children every week about cyber safety, and every week children in primary school tell me about the really scary things that they see online. They don't generally talk with a trusted adult, and they do have nightmares, and they think about it for months and months and months. So you can see how this is really challenging and complex.
Yeah, because like you said, you're not dealing with even an adult's brain and a, you know, maturity to process what's happened. They're so little, and they're trying to process it, and it just comes out in such different ways.
Yeah, and Sarah, they're trying to process it and make sense of it. And depending on their age as well, they may not even have the language to express and tell someone. Or if they do have the language, they might be using language that and think that they're telling someone, but it's not language that's understood by the person they're telling. So you can just see that all these layers, you start layering them on top of each other. And I just really want people to take away from this that this is not easy. This is really, really difficult, and that you know, compassion and kindness and empathy that we show people, I think, just has to be right out in the front of this.
This is obviously going to be another very difficult question, but how can parents identify someone, you know, or try to start identifying or analysing people in their children's lives that perhaps could be dangerous to their child, or what are signs of grooming, for instance?
Yeah, okay. So I guess, certainly I'll always say, you know, if you ever get, you might call it that gut instinct or that feeling or your intuition about someone or something that's happened, words that are used or a behavior or something you observe. Just as we teach children to listen to the signs and observe the sort of signals that their bodies give them on the inside and the outside, first and foremost, I think that as adults, we have to do that. So, and this is where it gets difficult, Sarah. The reality is, and I often say this, if I got a really bad feeling about someone, or my child got a really bad feeling about someone, my child's not going to want to spend time with them, and B, if I'm getting a bad feeling about someone, then you know, I'm unlikely. Very unlikely to allow my child to spend time with them. And this is where why I think this is a silent epidemic, and it is an epidemic, is because the people that sexually abuse children are someone that is normally known to the child, but also almost entirely known to the parents as well. So it's not just the child that's groomed, it's the child's family, and sometimes it's the wider community. And the reality is that, you know, for my own children, I've got two boys. I want people in their life that they trust, that they can talk with about anything, and it doesn't matter what it is. And I want them surrounded by those adults. I want them to have teachers at school that they can talk with. I want them to have, their friends, parents, people that they feel they can talk to. I want them to have a good relationship with their sporting coaches, because I know that through their life, as much as I want them to talk with me, and as much as I've set the space up for them to do that, I'm not always going to be that one. So we want people in our children's lives. And I still always come back to the overwhelming, 99%, I would say, of the trusted adults in children's lives are there for the right reasons. We just have to allow for the fact that there are some people that take up positions, that enter our lives and that may befriend us or befriend our child, and they do have an ulterior motive. How hard is that to consider? So I guess first and foremost, listen to your gut feeling, but the reality is we can't rely on that entirely, because, sometimes we're going to get it wrong. And so grooming, and I think it's important that people understand what grooming is, that is referring to some behaviours or actions that, it's deliberate. Usually it's somewhat planned on the part of the person who is grooming. Those actions are really designed to, they establish either an emotional connection with the child or the child's carers, so that, they can gain access to the child. And so that is manipulation that's sometimes very subtle. So it's very hard to pick. It can be drawn out. This can go on for weeks, but often months and sometimes years. It's premeditated. It's quite calculated. So this is why, it's hard. It's hard for parents to identify. We know, though, that, a lot of grooming, I often say, happens in plain sight, but often it's not observed as that until after. When looking back in hindsight, someone might think, oh, yes, that makes sense. But we can't, hold ourselves to such a high level, because often we can't see it at the time. Someone that wants to sexually abuse a child, ultimately, in nearly all cases, the actual sexual abuse is going to happen in isolation. So there's not going to be someone else around. But a lot of the grooming behaviours are going to happen in plain sight. And so I guess this is where it's so difficult for parents, but we do need to be mindful of, who our child spends time with, and look at, people that are spending time alone with our children, people that may be giving our children gifts or, affection or attention and praise. They're the things that we can look at. But being really honest, sometimes we are just not going to be able to pick that. And so this is where we can teach our children some skills and strategies. And in doing that, we are in no way making children responsible to keep themselves safe, because the reality is that is the job of every trusted adult in a child's life. And we can talk about some of those things in more detail if you like.
Yeah, that would be great. Before we go into that, I thought, when a disclosure is made, what do we do then? How do we support them, and how much can we question them? Obviously, I have a police background as well, so I know that a lot of people would ask me that as well. And they've started talking to me, and I quickly told them to be quiet because I didn't want to mess anything up or just race to the police station. So it's a bit of guidance around that would be amazing, because, like you said, there may be people listening that this is their reality.
I guess what I want to say is that if a child discloses or tells you something, because I think that's the word we understand best. If a child tells you something, what I'm going to say now is important. But what we also know is very many children who are sexually abused do not tell anyone until they're adults. Consider this language: if a friend or a family member who's an adult discloses or tells you about their own experience, because, as I said, oftentimes the way that an adult responds to a child or the way an adult responds to another adult about their disclosure of abuse can have a huge impact on that child or that adult's safety and their recovery from the trauma and abuse. And I guess, you know, first and foremost, if a child does tell you about abuse, there's some words that I think we could use on every occasion. And I've used these words with many adults as well. You know, first and foremost, and I want to keep this simple, and then I'll go into it in a little bit more detail. But first and foremost, thank the child or thank that person in your life for telling you, and maybe even let them know that that may have been so, so difficult for them. Acknowledge that. Do you know what? I'm sorry that that happened to you. I am so sorry that that was your experience. It was not your fault. I believe you, and I'm going to help you, or I'm here to support you. So depending on whether it's a child or an adult, that's what people need to hear. They
empathy.
That's why I say everything I do, and when I'm talking with young people, it's actually getting them to think in this way. Put yourselves into someone else's shoes, and you know, it could be any of us at any point in our life that we're supporting someone that we love or someone, you know, that's in our community. So first and foremost, that's what I would always say. And I use that language when I speak with adults, and every week I have an adult tell me about their story. Something else to keep in mind is something we learned from the Royal Commission is that generally speaking, if children don't disclose abuse in childhood or in their adolescence, they oftentimes will hang on to that information for a very long time. So for females, it's likely over 20 years after that sexual abuse has stopped that they will first tell someone. And for our male victims who are survivors of child sexual abuse, it can be, you know, 28 to 32 years after sexual abuse has occurred that they first tell someone. So I just want that to sink in for a moment, that if someone, a child, doesn't have any skills or strategies or doesn't have people in their life that they can speak with, and if someone doesn't listen to them and doesn't believe them and doesn't get them the help they need, it could be a very long time before that child ever speaks of it again. So we've got this finite opportunity to really engage in this space. It's so important that if a child does tell you that they're feeling unsafe or if they're being sexually abused or any other form of abuse, that we find a private space to speak with the child. We want to protect that child, but we want to protect any other children that may be around as well. Giving that child your full attention, you know, I often say you need to, as best you can, maintain a relatively calm appearance. Now, I'll often say that might mean you have to be like a duck, and that is on the surface, it's all calm and serene, and underneath your legs are just, you know, crazily trying to keep you above water. And you know what? Sometimes parents, carers, teachers, whoever, you'd never quite know how you might react when you're in this situation. If your child sees pornography online and you just don't know how to respond, sometimes you might have quite a physical reaction to that. All I'll say is if that does happen, acknowledge that with the child. You know what? I was really upset by what I just heard, but I was not upset at you. So our kids need to know that, yeah, you're upset. I'm so frustrated. I'm so disappointed that you've seen this or you've heard this, but I'm not upset with you. I'm not angry with you, because sometimes kids will think, you know, if you have a reaction, they will think that it's their fault. Don't be afraid to say the wrong thing, generally speaking. Just listen. Reassure the child that, you know, talking about it and telling is, acknowledge it's difficult, but it's the right thing to do. And let the child tell you in their own words what has happened. It's really important that we don't ask like leading questions and really probe for a lot of information. So the way that we can do that is to use a very open question. So if let's just say an example, a child says that they don't feel safe going home. So instead of jumping to, something bad happening to you at home, you could just reframe that and say to the child, you know, tell me more about why you're feeling unsafe, or tell me more about why you don't want to go home. And then you can allow the child to speak in their own words. We don't want children to be going into a huge amount of detail with the first person that they tell, because they are going to have to potentially tell again to someone from child protection or police. And what we do know is that the more times that someone has to recount something that's happened, we start to lose information and detail. And And very often children and even adult survivors of sexual abuse and other offences, if they've told, say, a responding police officer or they've told a teacher and then they have to tell someone else and tell someone else, what they start to do is they drop information off because in their mind they're like, well, I've already told someone that, yeah, and they'll pass that on and then it doesn't happen. And let the child take their own time, let them use their own words, don't make promises that you can't keep. So that is, some children might say you can't tell anyone, and you have to let children know at the outset that there are times when you do have to tell someone. Let children know what you're going to do next and talk through why you're going to do that. And I mean in relation to if you have mandatory reporting obligations, and do not confront the person that's alleged to have done anything at all. And Sarah, I might just share something that happened to me very recently. It was at a school, a high school, and I was talking to a group of children about sexual abuse, and we were dispelling some of the myths that exist and making sure that the children you have accurate information in a way that is age and developmentally appropriate. And at the end of that session, a young girl started walking towards me, and this happens very frequently. She had tears in her eyes. She's 12 years of age, in year seven. And, you know, usually children stop a little distance away from me and then, you know, start talking about whatever. And she just kept coming, and I was watching her, expecting her to kind of stop and then have a conversation. And she just threw her arms around me, and she was, you know, held on, and I put my arms around her. She was sobbing. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to stand here as long as I possibly can until she's in control. She does what she wants to do next. And I just held her. She soaked my shirt in tears. And then she pulled away, and she looked up at me with these, she's a child, looked up at me with these big eyes, and she said, oh, thank you so much for talking about that, because, you know, I'm not living with my family at the moment because my brother did some things to me at home, and now I have to live with someone else. And, you know, my heart broke, and that just reinforced for me in that moment that having these conversations is important. For those that have perhaps not experienced an unsafe situation, and hopefully we can continue that, but these conversations are important for those that have had an experience. They need to know, they need to hear that if it happened, it was never their fault. It was not something that they did. And so, you know, I go into all of my work knowing that sitting in a room of children, of young people, of adults, there will be victim survivors in that room, and if nothing else, I want them to know that what happened was not their fault. It was not anything that they did. It was not their responsibility to have made sure that didn't happen.
Yeah, it's so powerful. Gosh, you're making me emotional, taking me right back to that stage.
I know.
I've been out of this world for a while now, and it is. You never ever leave it behind, I think. And I mean, there'll be people listening right now that this is taking them back to their childhood, and, you know, we totally acknowledge that. And I think that, you know, from what you just said with her framing it as I can't live at home anymore, to her, in her little mind, that could be a punishment for her. Like, I've lost something and I've been moved away, and this has happened because I've told. And by you telling her these things, you've put that back in her head of going, you've done the right thing. These things may have happened as a result, but you've done the right thing by speaking up and telling somebody and, you know, and getting safety.
Absolutely. And I guess this is where we have to acknowledge as well that, you know, telling sometimes for a child can feel like they've done the wrong thing. And, you know, if they've been groomed and sexual abuse has happened, and one of the things that they've been told, or one of the threats that's been made to them, is if you ever tell anyone, this is going to rip our family apart.
The police are going to take you away from me.
Yeah, and for this child, exactly what she was, potentially told is what happened. And this is where, for me, I think a big space that we need to really make sure is well funded is the therapeutic supports for victims of sexual abuse, but also working with those young people that also perhaps have displayed some harmful sexual behaviours. We need to be working with all children in this space, and I think that's an area that is massively underfunded.
Oh, dear. All right. So let's go into how we can empower our kids. eSafe, your website, has so many resources. And I've spoken about quite a few of the books you've listed on your website as well on my socials that I found along the way. And they're so empowering and easy, you know, open that conversation with kids. So again, where all of those will be in the show notes, you'll be able to access all the resources that Kaylin recommends. Shall we break it down into pre-primary first and some things that we can do to educate our kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think pre-primary age children or younger is a really great place to start. And anyone that's probably heard me speak will know that I always say we need to be starting and considering having these conversations and providing this education a lot earlier than we perhaps might think we need to. But the reality is we do it in a way that is very age and developmentally appropriate. So, you know, the first time I'm changing my little boy's nappy on the change table, you know, I'm talking to him because we talk to our children and I'm changing a nappy. Ooh, this smells and what have you. And I'll say to my son, do you know what? And, you know, he's a newborn, but I'm saying to him, you're going to be old enough to do this for yourself one day. And so just, you know, changing a child's nappy, which you have to do and you're going to do, but you can start the conversation that you're going to be doing this for yourself one day. And, you know, when you're bathing a child and you're helping them, you know, keeping themselves clean, you're showing them how to do it. And you know what, mummy's or daddy or whomever it is helping you to do this right now, but you're going to be big enough to do this for yourself. So we can start these conversations long before our children are talking. And I often suggest this is where we do it. And it's it is for the child, but mostly this is for the parent. It's so that you can build a little bit of confidence and so that you can kind of have that feeling of, so this is how I do it. Yeah, I've got this. So consider maybe in those very early years, it's practice. It's your practice. So there's lots of places we can start, but I guess one of the places I think with very young children that's a good place to start and is a relatively easy place to start, but perhaps the one that causes parents the most angst, is teaching or when we're talking with our children about the private parts of their body, perhaps we could use, you know, correct terms for those parts of the body.
Exactly where you were going with that. I started this, obviously, ex-cop, my children always referred to their body parts as penises.
Yes.
And it was all fine with my parents who are older, obviously. And they didn't they would sort of go, oh, you could see that they'd cringe a bit, but they knew why. But once my niece was born, oh, I could literally see my parents like shudder into their bodies when I would say to her, now wash your vagina, wash your vulva. There we go. Now, and you could see my dad was like literally curling into his body. He could hear me saying it to her. And I'm like, Dad, and he go, I know why you're doing it, I know why it's important. And they picked it up as well, and they would use it as well. But it's such a new, I think it's a really a new thing.
Yeah, it is. And so let's be kind to ourselves and to our parents who are grandparents. Like, let's just be kind to everyone and go, the reality is for most of us, this was not language that was used in our childhoods. It wasn't used in our adolescence. And so the reality is for many people, they're really uncomfortable with it. So let's just own that to start with. Yes, this is really challenging. It is. But what we know is that teaching children the correct terms for the private parts of their body in and of itself can be a protective factor, because a child who has the correct language for a part of a body is a child that if they do tell someone and uses that terminology, it's not going to be ambiguous. It's not going to leave someone trying to work out or entirely missing what the child is saying. And I'll just give you two real world examples that have happened very recently in my work. So one of them, so a little girl about year four, at the end of a school day, in the busyness of the end of a school day, tells her teacher that she doesn't want to go home that day because dad parks his car in her garage. Now, the teacher could have easily missed that. Had the child said, I don't want to go home today because dad puts his penis in my vagina, that would be all that child needed to say. And do you know what? In that child's mind, that child has identified that they're not feeling safe and what's happening is not something that feels okay for them, that they have spoken to someone trusted. That person appeared to listen to them, but then if that child had got hurried off home, that is a child that has told, and that is a child that did not necessarily get the help that they might need. Now, luckily, the teacher caught this and able to work out what exactly was going on. And then I was actually at a school about 3 or 4 years ago, and I was in a pre-primary. And I was standing outside in the playground with one of the teachers and talking before I was going to speak to the children. And these are wee little ones. And the kids are running around and I am looking out at the children and a teacher's talking to me. And I see a little girl walking along it was a tree branch, a really big tree branch, and she's walking along and she fell, she slipped and she landed on the branch, and I thought, oh, that's going to have hurt. She landed, you know, on the private parts of her body, on a vulva area, and I watched to see what would happen, because she just kind of got up and she looked like she'd hurt herself, and then I saw her kind of wander over to where we were, and I was just listening to see what she said, and she told the teacher that she had just hurt her possum, and I just thought, oh my goodness, this is why I do what I do. And you could see the teacher trying to go possum, possum, and looking around, and I just said, oh, maybe you could ask her to show you where the possum is, and she pointed to her private parts. And do you know what? These things happen more often than people might think. So if we teach our children the private parts of their body and we say vagina and vulva, penis, testicle, scrotum, bottom or anus, you know, nipples, breasts, just in the same way we would say head, shoulders, knees and toes, it normalizes this type of language. Now, as I said, start this when children are really young, on the change table, when you're bathing them. And at that time, it's practice for you, because these are words that perhaps you need to become comfortable saying. Also, when we talk to children about private parts of their body, and please, please avoid using words like their rude parts or even just saying rude parts or bad parts, because what I know from speaking to way too many adult survivors of child sexual abuse is what happens is that child who becomes a young person, becomes an adult, when they're told that that part of their body maybe is rude or we don't even talk about it, then what happens is the child thinks that they're rude or they're bad. And so that can feed into things that an offender might already be saying to a child. So just name them as they are. Now, sometimes families may have home names or family names, or perhaps depending on your culture or where you're from, there might be another word that you use for the private parts. And so it's just important that children know the correct names in Australia and the English names for the private parts, that perhaps they use other names at home. But if they need to talk with someone about their private parts because they're hurting, or they've got questions about them, or if someone does touch the private parts of their body, it's really important that they use the correct words, because then people don't get confused. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does make total sense. And I'm sure most police will have a story of a word that was used or, that just was missed, because there's so many different words that people use, and it just needs to come back to those simple words that will be understood by any person that may hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Sarah, we've got to be realistic as well. So I've got two boys, and I often say that they went through a period where they loved nothing more than they heard lots of words at school, and they would say every word but penis, and it was a bit of a, they were having a bit of a laugh, and it was funny. And I said to them, these are the words that you might hear, these are the words that some kids may have been taught, but and I just reiterated with them, if you've ever got questions about your private parts, if they're ever hurting, if we ever need to go and see a doctor, and then later on, and if anyone touched or tried to touch their private parts, that they just need to use the correct language. So, there are some words in common usage. If a child said that, someone was touching their willy or their doodle, then we probably have a pretty good idea about what part of the body they're talking about. But, when a child discloses and says, someone's touched their possum or their garage or their money box or their secret pocket or their flower, or I had a child, a two-year-old once, who referred to her bum. Now, in that family, there was a front bum and a back bum, and the child was only two, so they were just using the word bum. And that became very problematic, because we needed to work out where the child was actually referring to. So, there's great books like Only for Me, Everyone's Got a Bottom, My Underpants Rule. There's There's so many child-friendly books that can assist you. I've done book readings of all of them with author's permission. They're all on my website and on the socials. And the reason they're there is so parents can see, like, this is the type of language you can use, and this is a resource or a book that you could use to introduce the topic if you're just not quite sure how to start.
Yeah, books are amazing. They are. The same as, you know, when you talk about other kinds of ways to keep our little ones safe, you know, is safe secrets.
Yes.
And listening to their instincts is a huge one in my house, because our little one does have quite bad anxiety.
Mm.
And we, you know, teach them that that feeling in your tummy, that is your body. That's your body superpower. And there's some beautiful books out there around that as well. And that's a such an easy way to start a conversation, because that's when people say, I just don't know. How do I talk to, like, when do I do this? When they're just sitting at the dinner table, I say, hey guys, by the way, don't let anyone touch your penis. Like, how do I start this conversation? A book can be such a beautiful way to start.
Absolutely. And those warning signs that you're talking about, Sarah, like, they're an involuntary response. They're there to keep us safe. You know, they are our inbuilt alarm system. If anyone wants more information on that, look at the work of Bruce Perry. But, you know, I used to say to my children, when I was teaching warning signs initially, I would use other animals. So we can look at the cat or a dog or an animal, and you can tell whether they like the way that you're touching them by the way that they respond. And we need to, you know, observe that. So this is starting to teach our children in the very, very early years about starting to respect other people and animals' body cues. I would say to my kids when they were very young and they were going to do something that they hadn't done before, or perhaps they were had gone a little bit higher on a climbing frame, you know, how are you feeling? So I just let them tell me how they were feeling. So then now they're talking about their feelings, and I'd say, you know, we're just this, and then you can talk to the kids about what's happening on the inside and the outside of their body. And that's where they can say, you know, oh, my heart's beating really fast, if they've got that language, or my legs feel like jelly. And that's how easy it is to start these conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that, like, for our little boy that has anxiety, when he says to me, okay, I feel like I'm going to vomit, or my tummy's hurting, it's then given us the ways for me to break it down and go, okay, it's tomorrow's a daycare day.
Yes.
I can see where this is from. I'm not going, oh, I better give you Panadol, or are you sick? I can identify quite quickly now with the way that he's speaking of, okay, this is an issue that we need to sit down and we need to work through.
Absolutely. And Sarah, something that's really important there is protective behaviours or child abuse prevention education, say body safety, depending on the language that's used in states and in different organisations. The reality is these skills that we can teach children, so safe and unsafe secrets, assertiveness, personal space, body autonomy and consent, warning signs, talking about feelings, these are transportable skills, they're life skills, and they don't necessarily ever have to apply to a situation of abuse or sexual abuse. These concepts are so transferable. And I always say that to parents, you know, my hope is that I give you this information and you're using it in a completely different context.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful thing about this. This is not just for prevention of sexual abuse or prevention of abuse. These are for skills for managing life. They're life skills.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bell Fever, Australia's most highly rated personalised jewellery store. It's a family-run Australian company specialising in creating handcrafted, personalised jewellery. And with over 17,000 five-star reviews, you know you're in safe hands. Customise all kinds of jewellery and items such as keyrings with inscriptions and photos. They can even turn handwritten notes or drawings into a special keepsake. I would love to have one of Noxie's masterpieces turned into a special charm. Whether you're searching for a custom piece for yourself, a gift for a special occasion, or wanting to keep a loved one close after a loss, Bell Fever has a range to suit everyone. I showcase my beautiful heart pendant necklace with my four precious boys' names written on my Instagram. Backed with a 365-day warranty and 100% love-it guarantee, you can breathe easy when ordering special keepsakes. Use code TCP20 for a big discount at bellfever.com.au. That's BELLE Fever at www.bellfever.com.au and use code TCP20.
Let's touch on safe secrets, because yes, we've both mentioned it a couple of times now. And obviously, like, I think, and well, actually, no, probably not you. You're probably the one exception. But I was going to say, a lot of people in law enforcement or child protection and things like that could easily fall into a opinion that, oh, everybody knows this stuff.
Yeah.
Because I know that it's just something that rolls off the tongue with me that, you know, we don't have secrets, we have surprises. And, you know, secrets don't ever involve not telling a person unless it's for a, you know, like a fun, unless it's going to be told eventually, you know, it's never forever. But these are not things that people talk about. So I would love to hear your take on it all.
Again, this is where we've just got to be kind and compassionate and empathetic. If you are not working in this space, and, you know, I work with a lot of people who are working in this space and don't have this knowledge, it's okay. It's okay that you don't know this, because, do you know what? You would probably never have been spoken about this as a child.
Nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, and this is why this is so great, because we can have this conversation, and I hope that we can inspire some parents and some carers and some teachers to have the conversations. So, yeah, with younger children, it may be the case that you just don't have secrets in your family and they're, you know, surprises. Now, what I'll always say is sometime around the when children go to school, you may consider using language of safe secrets, the ones that are okay to keep, and unsafe secrets, the ones that we tell someone that we trust. And do you know what? That is going to be up to, you know, for families to decide when they use that language. But let's give the kids some things that they can think about. So safe secrets are the ones that usually, you know, they're linked with feelings of happiness or excitement, you know, because if we've bought a gift for someone for a birthday present, we've got our craft on at school and we've made something lovely for mum or dad or someone for Mother's Day, Father's Day, Christmas, you know, we're feeling pretty excited about keeping that. You know, you can tell a safe secret if you want to. You know, generally with, you know, safe secrets, child is not going to be getting warning signs. Safe secrets are ones that we generally keep for, you know, a fairly short period of time. And that's the way that we can talk to kids about safe secrets. Now, unsafe secrets, and you're going to have to scale this depending on the age of your child. Obviously, I would not be saying all of this to a child of five straight away. I'd just build on this. But any secrets, whether you are asked to keep a secret in the real world or online, that makes you feel scared or upset, confused, embarrassed, ashamed, add all those words in, it's really important that you tell someone that you trust. If you're getting any warning signs about a secret that you've been asked to keep or told to keep, it's important that if you can, you speak with a trusted adult. If you're having to, you've got a secret that you've been told that you can't tell anyone else, you've got to keep it forever, you're never allowed to tell, that's an unsafe secret. And, you know, if you can, speak with someone that you trust. If someone ever threatens you or bribes you or tries to make you feel guilty or blackmail you to keep a secret, that's unsafe. And if you are feeling hurt on the inside or the outside of your body, that is unsafe, and speak with a trusted adult. And there's a few others that we can add in there as well, but I hope that gives people somewhere to start. And when I teach cyber safety, digital wellness, when I'm talking about pornography, I use the language of safe and unsafe secrets, warning signs, and all of this content. I just push it across into the online space, because children online that are harmed, that are groomed online or sent things online, are often told they have to keep it a secret. So talking about tricks, talking about lies, talking about threats and blackmail, guilt, shame, bribes, is really important. And quickest and easy, or probably one of the easiest ways we could explain this is, we just have to be so careful with, you know, the physical affection. I'm sure we'll talk about this, but the physical affection that we sometimes may force our children into without thinking about how this could impact their safety. Because, you know, if we're telling our children that, you know, grandma's going to be really upset with them if they don't get a hug, or, do you know what, if you go and sit on Santa's lap and you smile really nicely, I'm going to buy you an ice cream. We are starting to give our children really mixed messages.
Yeah, you're rewarding them for acting in a way and doing things with their body in a way that you've asked them to. And if you're telling them that, hey, don't do things because people are asking you, or if they're, you know, bribing you, and that's how we're acting, it's very confusing.
Yeah, I'm being asked to keep an unsafe secret, but actually this is kind of the same as when grandma comes to visit or bloody, bloody, blah. And so the implicit and the explicit messages we give our children sometimes can be really counterproductive to safety. So it's just something to consider for parents.
And it's more about just reframing it. So I know my middle child is either doesn't want to go near someone or look at somebody, or he wants to be literally morphed inside their body. You know, like he wants to be, he goes under my mum's shirt and pops his head out the top of the neck. Like he wants to be, you know, so it's giving them an option. So I know a lot of parents will then say, well, they have to say hello to their grandmother because I'm teaching my child respect. And absolutely, you can do that too. Just give them an option. Would you like to give Nan a hug, or would you like to just wave and say hi? You know, it doesn't need to be something where it's a you must do this or you will lose that or you will gain this.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where this is a life skill and it's transferable because I would not be, you know, if we talk about anything, just, you know, unsafe people or a tricky person, we're not using the word, you know, predators or pedophiles or child sex offenders, anything like that with children in primary school. You know, I say to kids, you know, it's in understanding this in the context of child sexual abuse, the child very often knows their abuser. So just who the person is will mean that a child may not tell a trusted adult. But we can explain to kids that if they're ever at a place or in a space where they normally feel safe and they start to feel unsafe, that now might be a tricky place. If they're with someone they know and usually enjoy spending time with, but that person is behaving or using words or doing things that start to feel like kind of tricky or that they're uncomfortable, this might now be a tricky person, and encouraging children to speak with trusted adults if they ever experience a tricky person, a tricky place, a tricky behavior, their tricky words, and reassure children that, you know, it is okay for them to say no to someone. It is okay for them to move away. It is okay for them to run away. It's okay for them to yell for help. But if they can't do that, because of who they're with or where they are, as soon as they can talk with a trusted adult. Because the reality is we often tell children, you know, to say no, stop, go away, move away. But from my experience, very often for children, that actually is not possible. So we need to make children feel that, you know what, so they don't feel ashamed or self-blame because they didn't move away, because they didn't say stop. We need to, and that's how that language can really help children out.
Another really practical thing people can do listening is identify those trusted people with your children. So, you know, we name our trusted people. And although I obviously, like most, don't believe that anyone that my children name as their top five trusted people, if it is one of those people on that trusted list, so we tell them if something happens, you tell one of those trusted people, whoever you see first or whoever you're more comfortable with. You know, like you said, maybe our kids may not always want to come to us, but they feel more comfortable to talk to their auntie or their nana or whoever. But if one of those situations arises from one of your trusted people, or you tell a trusted person and nothing happens, you need to tell other people on that list. You need to keep telling trusted people until somebody helps you.
Absolutely. Everything you've just said is what I would say. Helping our children to identify those trusted adults, people that they feel they have access to, firstly, you know, that they feel so they're available to them, would listen to them, would believe them, and would help or support them if they ever needed it, and that they could talk to about anything, and it doesn't matter what it is. This is where another strategy that we teach children, and which is persistence. The reality is that very often, sometimes children do tell a trusted adult, and for whatever reason, perhaps they're not listened to, not believed, and maybe they don't get the help and support that they need, that if you tell someone on your network or one of those trusted adults and they don't listen to you, they don't believe you, they don't help you, or if you're still feeling unsafe, then it's really important that you speak with someone else. And if that person doesn't listen or believe or assist, then you talk with someone else. And we always give children numbers to keep up their sleeve. So letting them know that there's 000 if they need to call the police, the kids helpline. As children get a bit older, we can talk about Headspace, we can talk about the office, the e-safety commissioner for older children, and all of those service providers that are there for our kids. Because we've got some pretty alarming research in Australia, and it's consistent around the world. There is a relatively higher percentage of about I think it's about 1 in 3 adults would not believe a child if they disclosed abuse, or they would believe the word of an adult over a child. And that is something that we need to change.
Mm, And I think that people, like you said, like our kids may feel comfortable to speak to one of those trusted people about one particular area, but perhaps not. You know, they may speak to that person if they're being bullied, but they may not be comfortable with the same trusted adult if they're being sexually abused. So we need to have a range of people, perhaps in and out of the family circles and things, you know, having a teacher or a coach or someone that's, you know, out, a little bit separated as well is really powerful.
Absolutely. And I always say that to kids in particular, because I do a lot of work with young people around, you know, pornography, which can be a conversation parents are really scared of. Yeah. And this is important. There are going to be people in your life that you feel comfortable talking with about one thing, but not another thing. And that is okay. We just want to make sure you've got a good network of people around you so that you can talk with someone.
So let's move, we're sort of going between pre-primary and primary. Prepping for big school, I know for me, one of my biggest fears was sending my little one off to primary school for the first time was like, how is he going to go to the bathroom on his own? And, you know, that's a big, we've never, ever, ever let them go to the toilet on their own before, and now they're going to be. And our school's broken up into a K to two bathroom and a 3 to 6 bathroom. So that made me feel a little bit better, but it was still one of those things that made me a little bit anxious. And I hear it a lot.
Yeah, so I guess, prepare. You know, there's so much preparation when a child's, transitioning from kindy pre-primary into primary school. I think there's transitions for some kids, you know, every year. But I guess this is where, as our kids are getting a little bit older, if we're thinking about safety, this is where we can be also talking to our children about there's public places and there's private places. There is, you know, behaviours that are private that we do. There's things that we do in public. So, you know, in terms of safety, some things that we could start to, you know, tell our children is that, you know, when you're using, the toilets or the bathrooms at a school, that's you're doing something private, and that this depends on if there's a urinal or individual toilets. But if you're, you know, if you're in a private space doing a private activity, it doesn't matter if you're at home, you're at a grandparent's house, at a friend's house, or a family member's, or at school, then you can expect privacy when you're using that space. So if anyone comes into that space when you're using it, you can tell them to go away or to stop. Or if you don't feel that you can do that then and there, then go and speak with a trusted adult as soon as you can.
Yeah, it sounds so simple, but having the conversation is so empowering, because if that child finds himself in that situation, it's not a new situation. It's something that their brains have already turned to that could be a possibility, not to be scared of, but just to then know, oh, this is my out. This is how I move through this situation.
There's so much we could talk about. We'd need hours. But, you know, when our kids are very young, we can talk to them about private clothing when we're doing the folding. We can talk to kids about public and private information in the very early years. Private behaviours, often people talk about, you know, farting, burping and picking your nose is private, and we don't do that in public, which ideally that would be great. But when I talk about, and I've got two boys. So when I talk about private behaviours with my boys, though, I've said to them, if you're going to touch your own private parts, that's a private behaviour. You're touching a private part of your body that, you know, this is normal, this is healthy. Oftentimes children do touch their own private parts. It's not sexual, but adults might perceive it that way. Some children touch themselves because, you know, they're curious. It self-soothes because it feels nice, or it's unconscious, just like sucking a thumb or biting nails. So I've always just said to my boys, you know, if you're touching a private part of your own body, then you need to do that in a private space. So the bedroom, the bathroom, or the toilet. Sitting on the lounge next to mum is not private. So, and that's the way I've spoken to my own boys about that sort of act, without shaming them, without making them think that it's rude or bad. Talking about public and private, you know, clothing, information, places and spaces, behaviors, body parts, photos and videos, I can honestly say from having children that were taught this from the moment that they came home from the hospital to my oldest son is now 14, it has just allowed us to have so many conversations about a whole host of things, and we've got the language and we've got some comfort there and we've got some trust, and my boys know that there is nothing in this world that would ever make me stop loving them. There's nothing they could do that would mean I would love them less, and that they can always come with me and come to me and talk with me about anything at all, and I'll always be there to listen to them.
particularly with kids, and we're saying like it's a bit ick to talk to our kids about this kind of stuff, is the more forbidden and like off topic it is, the more appealing and more curious, the more they're going to try and find those answers in another way. They're not going to just stop being curious. They're going to find out. So we can either tell them in a safe way, which is very factual, and give them information, or we can let them be exposed to it from someone perhaps we don't want them to be exposed to it from.
You know, peers are great support for young people, particularly as we get into secondary school and they're starting to pull away from us, which is awful. No, it's the way it's meant. It's, yes.
I'm not ready for that. No, I'm not even close to that.
I'm not. I'm hanging on. No, do you know, it's horrible. It is. But it's the way it is. And we've just got to go with that. So, you know, friends are great for support, but I would never want to leave the education of my children around relationships, sexuality, body safety, and all of these important things. I don't want to leave that to my children's peers to provide them with that education. And I absolutely don't want to leave it to the pornography industry to teach my children about those things. And I'm never going to rely entirely on schools to provide my children with all the information that I think they need. And that's why by supporting parents, inspiring parents, hopefully we can have more of these conversations that are happening at home, they're happening at school, they're happening in the community. And we know that research shows that, you know, children who receive consistent messages in those spaces are more likely to be confident in responding to unsafe situations and accessing help and support if they need it. So it takes a village, and we all have a role to play in keeping our children safe and in their care and in their supervision. And so we need to work together.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even just about keeping our own kids safe, but it's giving them those healthy relationships going forward and making sure that they're, you know, I always say that my boys will be boys that, you know, other people's children are safe with. Like they need to have respect for everybody's personal space and everybody's choices and everyone's, you know, right to consent and things. And they need to understand what all of that looks like. So it starts at such a young age with their own body, and then the conversations continue on as they go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this, Sarah, where we had this opportunity to share information with parents, and we're only touching the surface of it today. But you know, for me and parents that I've spoken to 5 or 6 years ago that come back to me and say, "Oh, I'm so glad that, you know, I was there then, because I've been able to, you know, segue into all these other areas." You know, as children become young people, and you know, I can teach my children at a very young age that that their body boundaries need to be respected, and the flip side of that is that they need to respect other people's body boundaries. And I can teach my children what consent, you know, looks like, what it feels like, what it sounds like. I can teach them that they can set boundaries, they can express those boundaries, and they can do that assertively if they need to, and they need to accept and respect other people's boundaries, and that we can disagree with someone, we can challenge, you know, their opinion or something, but we don't attack or challenge a person. We
fight the topic, not the person.
Absolutely. And these are the conversations, and this is the space that we can then take this to.
Absolutely. So we have got another episode planned to deal with the cyber side of world and pornography and things, because like you said, we could talk for days and days.
Absolutely.
And days. You know, your workshops are much, much longer than just an hour in duration. But the last sort of thing I wanted to touch on was just, you know, say there are parents listening right now with high school kids, and it's been very, very big spoken about at the moment in Australia about boys and, you know, rape culture and the concepts of consent and how we teach our teenagers this. And I think a lot of parents would be really unsure on how to start a conversation with their teenage boys or girls, knowing that they can't just sit down and read a lovely rhyming book and lead into a conversation. So how can they start these conversations when perhaps they haven't yet?
So for anyone that's listening that has the opportunity to start this much, you know, much younger, start conversations around consent, personal space, body autonomy, boundaries, assertiveness. Start it in the early years, long before it has anything to do with, you know, sexual consent. That's my first recommendation. Get growth and development conversations started in the early years. There's some awesome books to do that. Make sure children, you know where babies come from and all of that. But you know what? For some parents, they have young people and they've been catapulted into this space and they don't know what to do with it. So talking you know, with children around consent, it is so much more than yes or no. Now, I used to teach sex offence legislation, and, you know, on paper, I can give you a definition and all of that. But understanding that this can be complex, it can be nuanced, and we need to be talking about this in so much more than saying yes or saying no. We need, you know, in Australia, just 2 years ago, there was the National Community Attitudes Towards Violence Against Women survey, and 1 in 7 young Australian males believed that a male would be justified in raping a woman if she initiated sex but then changed her mind. Now, you could use something like that to start a conversation with your young person, and we need to listen to the voices of young people. And I think and I believe that the majority of young people have great capacity to think critically about this topic, and we need to talk with them. So you could use that study and that stat in some way and say to your child, what do you think about that? Why do you think that is the response that people have given? Where did that come from? So we can start to challenge social norms, ideally when children are much younger, but we can start that conversation, you know, with adolescents as well. Have conversations about what's happening at the moment, and talk about stereotypes and how they influence our beliefs and our behaviours, our expectations, and talk about, you know, if we don't challenge these, we'll struggle to address violence, and particularly violence against women and children.
I had someone interesting say to me the other day that she was a victim of sexual abuse at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. And when she was going through the stages of whether she was going to tell her parents, she'd almost gotten the courage to. And then she heard her parents listening to an article on the news. And her parents' response was, well, why was she at that party? Mm-hmm. Why was she drinking alcohol? And in that moment, she said, I knew there and then I would never, ever, ever tell them what happened to me, because that I was at a party and I was drinking, although I was 13 and, you know, engaging in risky behavior that teenagers do. And that was it. The decision was made. She would never ever tell her parents. So it's what we're saying and doing around our children that are planting very strong seeds, as opposed to what we're even saying to them.
Yeah, I've had 1,000 conversations like that with young people, and something I would say, particularly about young males who are sexually abused or sexually assaulted, I really think there's a big conversation to have there as well. But the amount of young males and very old males and everything in between that I've spoken to who have wanted to tell someone, but just the way that we speak about, let's say, same-sex marriage or same-sex attracted people and diversity in our homes and in our communities can shut down the lines of communication for a young person. So we just have to be so careful with the way that we speak around our young people, because they are listening. And do you know what? It might not always be an unsafe situation that they're building up the courage to talk with us about. But if they get an understanding that, you know, you're not open to conversation and listening to different viewpoints, they won't engage in conversation. So sometimes we kind of have to push our own, you know, thoughts, feelings and beliefs to aside. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying we have to change them necessarily, but set up with our kids this space of listening to what they think. And for me, that is just so, so incredibly important. And if we're talking about consent with young people, it's not just about, this conversation's not just about consent. We need to be talking about, you know, pleasure. When I talk with young people, I'm talking about making sure that we're aware of the way someone that we're doing, wanting to do something with, be really in tune with how they're responding. So their non-verbals, is the person hugging you back? Are they touching you back? Are they kissing you back? Are they pulling you into them? Because if they're not, you know, we need to talk with children about when a human feels unsafe or they, you know, feel under threat, our body might freeze. We may lose the capacity to talk because our body is doing that. Our auditory system may be shutting down. So trying to teach young people not just the words and the ways in which they can, you know, check in with someone that is not like awkward, that can be kind of sexy if it needs to be or whatever. You know, we've got to take this conversation so much further than just consent. It's about respectful relationships, and these conversations again start in childhood, because we talk about friendships. What makes a good friend? What are the qualities we're looking for? And then when we've got young people, I'm saying to my boys, so back when we, you know, we're talking about friends and what makes a good friend. Yeah. So, you know, if you're going to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend or whatever you want to have, that's your, you know, doesn't bother me. But what are the qualities we're going to look for in that person? And have those conversations with your child, because this can also help with violence, because family and domestic violence, you know, it does affect young people's relationships as well. So there's so many spaces we can have, take this conversation.
I heard it described the other day on the internet as speaking to teenagers about enthusiastic consent coming down to, if it's not a hell yeah, it's a hell no. And I'm like, perfect. Like most teens are totally going to relate to that, you know, about making sure that both parties are a hell yeah before, you know, or it's a flat out no. It's not a maybe. It's not a convince me. It's a no.
Yeah. And I often say that to young people. I use a lot of humor, and I think young people seem to respond pretty positively to the way that I talk to them, because it's not a way that maybe other adults are talking with them. But yeah, and you know, I always talk about, you know, for both people, we've got to go, both people should be having a pretty awesome time most of the time, if not all the time, but maybe, you know, as you get older, you might go for most of the time. But, you know, we want to both be having a good time. And talking to young people about the pleasure you can get from pleasing someone else as well, these conversations, and yeah, it needs to be a absolutely hell yes, or whatever language you want to use. You know, sex is awesome, and we don't want to, you know, encourage, we want it to be positive. We want a positive conversation. It should be awesome. It should be great for everyone most of the time, if not all of the time. And, you know, those sort of intimate relationships, they need to be consensual. They need to be pleasurable. They need to be mutually beneficial. They need to be respectful. And they're the conversations we have with our young people. If you can't do it face-to-face, because you've got a finite window where kids actually listen to their parents about all sorts of things, and then you're so uncool and they maybe start to shut down a little bit.
Never.
No, do you know what? I'm hanging on at the moment, but I already know, based on the temperament of one of my boys, I know which one I have to approach slightly differently. So I have watched video, like documentaries with one. I have done voice recordings with one, because I'm like, you know, this is so awkward having your mum talk to you about this, this and this. So I've recorded this, and these are my thoughts. I mean, you can send me a message back. I've got one that actually likes writing, and so I will write little notes to him, and these are the important things. I use a lot of humor, and I just feed it into our everyday conversations, not all the time, because it becomes too much, like, mom, enough already. But you know, we just have the conversations, and we talk soon, talk often, talk about things that are going on in their life, and listen. Please listen to young people. They've got so much to say.
And I think there's so many people that aren't giving them the chance. Like, we're treating them like they're babies, and these kids are critically analyzing, you know, works of famous authors, and they're, the work that they're doing in schools, you know, coding computers, and they're doing these things that they're so intelligent. They can feel off other people's emotions. They can read other people. They can analyze situations. Give them a chance. Don't dumb it down.
Yeah. And that's what we need to do. And I came out and I tried, you know, I tried to be diplomatic, but the recent video that was made, I was just disappointed. Above all else, I was disappointed, because there was such an opportunity there. And I said there's no way I'd ever use that with young people. And then actually that's not entirely true. I would actually potentially use that video, had it stayed around, with young people to get their thoughts and feelings on how that video could have, how that could have been made. And that's my, you know, my concern is, are we engaging young people when we're creating resources for young people? The voice of young people, the voice of children, is very important, and we need to listen. Yes, we're adults, and yes, we know our children's brains are still developing. Yes, we know they're going to have trouble sometimes with impulse control and regulation and putting those brakes on. But don't ever discount young people's capacity to think critically, to think deeply. And they have got so much to say, and we need to listen. And when you listen, for me, oh, young people tell me a huge amount. And I'm an old person now. I'm getting pretty old. My kids say I'm squishy and getting wrinkly, and it's seriously, I'm uncool to them. Although my son, I had a year six tell me this week that I'm the coolest old person that he knows. He wished his mum was as cool as me. After I was talking about cyber safety and do it like a little bit differently to some others teach cyber safety, and he said that to me, and I said, don't worry, buddy, like my boys don't think I'm cool. Yeah. I came home to my son and I said, you wouldn't believe it, you know, a child that's only a year younger than you told me today that I'm really cool. And he said to me, Mum, you've got to be making that up. And I was like, and then he kind of winked at me and said, yeah, you're pretty cool. I was like, oh my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, and Kayleen's referring to the tragic milkshake and taco videos that were made by funded by our Department of Education that were put up on the Good Society website this week. It's the last week in April at the moment as we're recording, and yeah, they've one's been pulled down. And I think they were just done in a really patronizing, confusing, contradictory way, and you know, it made us all scratch our heads and go, why are we just not talking about kids like people, you know, like normal people that are able to understand words and phrases and just saying things without trying to hide behind these wacky analogies that didn't even make sense to us 30-year-olds. You
know? Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I try not to be too critical unless I have all the information. And so I haven't heard who made it and what their thought process and thinking was behind it. I'm a little concerned. Look, I'm not the holder of that information. I wonder who they spoke to, and there's a lot of questions I'd like answered there. But I'm not going to cast aspersions without having all of the information. I think we've got a bit of work to do. Maybe we should talk to young people next time. At least listen to them next time we're considering what we're producing to use with young people. And if not that, at least speak to people that are on the ground. And using evidence-based and research-based approaches, so not just, you know, the world according to, and talk to them about what they're seeing, what they're hearing, what do they think might be beneficial, because there's lots of fantastic people working in this space that, you know, really can contribute if we are invited into the conversation.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We are going to come back and have a chat about all things digital safety and pornography, just as maybe a teaser into the next one. What's the average age that our children are learning of or viewing pornography?
Oh, it's pretty scary, Sarah. So the research still tells us that somewhere between 11 and 13 years that children first have that exposure to pornography. Having said that, it appears that the average age of first exposure to pornography is overwhelmingly that of primary school age children. 8 years of age is the number that seems to be getting used a lot.
Seven, and when you told me that, I was immediately horrified.
Yeah, and if we look at some New Zealand research that was done very recently, one in four New Zealand young people, children, first saw pornography before the age of 12, and importantly, 71% of them were not looking for it when they first saw it. The pornography found our children. We've got some conversations to have, but you know what? My job and what I love doing, I'm so passionate about, is we can do this. I want to support parents to step into this kind of challenging, uncomfortable space and inspire them. You've got this. You can do this. Maybe we just give them a little bit of help and guidance.
Yeah, knowledge is power, right? And if we absolutely think about it and we know about it, we can do new things and do better and keep learning.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much for your time. You are absolutely amazing and doing such incredible things.
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in today. I would love to continue the conversation with you over on Instagram at the Conscious Project Podcast. Hit subscribe so you don't miss our next episode, and I would be so grateful if you would take a moment to leave me a 5-star review. It really does help. Take care.